That is officially correct, but their secret work started thousands of years before. Yet, as I mentioned before, the secrecy would have been all but pointless if today everybody would know when and where the Freemasons had been up to what. The public work by the London Lodge caused great consternation among the other Masonic lodges who accused the Londoners of treason. When this simmered down, the Freemasons began to spread all over Europe and the New World. Later, they emerged in the New World with the Declaration of Independence and with the Boston Tea Party, which was organized by the Boston Masonic Lodge. John Locke, for instance, used the Masonic tenets when he wrote the Constitution of the Offord Colony of South Carolina, which later became a Masonic bastion. The writings of Sir Francis Bacon also reflect the philosophies of the Freemasons. The Declaration of Independence was written and signed almost exclusively by Freemasons. George Washington and the most of his generals were Freemasons. It is a fact that without the work of the Freemasons, the United States of America would not exist today. Chapter 2. 17. The Elders of Zion. Another secret organization of immense influence sought to control England. The rich Jewish rabbis, the religious and political leaders of the crushed Jewish people, united their power in a group that became known as the Elders of Zion. The Zionists see themselves as the messianic elite of Judaism and expect all Jews of the world to show solidarity with their aims. Manfred Adler, The Sons of Darkness Part 2, from 1640 to 1689. The Elders of Zion in the Netherlands planned the English Revolution, the deposition of the Stuarts from the British throne, and loaned money to the many splinter parties. Years before, they had used their influence to have William I, the Silent, a German prince of the House of Nassau, lead the Dutch army and later to make him William Prince of Orange. They arranged a meeting between him and Mary, the eldest daughter of the Duke of York and sister of Charles II of England, and with the latter's brother and successor James. 2. William and Mary were married in 1677 and had a son, William III, who later married Mary II, the daughter of James II. Now the Dutch and British royal houses were related. In 1688 they forced the Stuarts, with the aid of the Whigs, a party of influential English and Scot personalities, from the throne, and in 1689 William III of Orange was named King of England. William III, who is purported to have been Freemason, founded in the same year the Loyal Orange Order, which is anti-Catholic and aimed at firmly establishing Protestantism in England. The order still exists today and has around 100,000 members in Ireland, where it is most strongly represented and is fanning the flames of the religious war. King William III soon got England involved in costly wars against Catholic France, which got England deep in debt. Here was William's chance to return the favor to the Elders of Zion. With the aid of the agent William Paterson, he persuaded the Treasury to borrow £1.25 million sterling from the Jewish bankers who had helped him to the throne. Since the state debts had risen dramatically, the government had no choice but to accept. The lending conditions were as follows: the names of the lenders are to remain secret, and they are granted the right to establish a Bank of England, Central Bank. The directors of the said bank are permitted to set the gold standard for paper money. They are permitted to lend £10 in paper money for every pound of gold deposited. They are permitted to consolidate the national debt and to raise the sum from the people by direct taxes. Thus the first private central bank, the Bank of England, was established. This kind of banking business brought a 50% profit on an investment by the bank of 5%. The English people had to pay for it. The lenders were not at all interested to have the sums they had loaned repaid, for the indebtedness gave them political influence. England's national debt rose from £1,250,000 in 1694 to £16 million in 1698. After William III, the House of Hanover succeeded to the British throne, and they are still there today, for the Windsors descend in a direct line from the House of Hanover. The Hanoverians provided all the monarchs up to 1901, When Edward VII married the Danish princess Alexandra and the name got changed to Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, the name of Edward's German father. On July 17, 1917, this name was changed to Windsor, as it still is today. It is understandable that many English people were not amused about the German rule, and several organizations tried to bring the Stuarts back to the throne. Because of this threat, the Hanoverians did no longer allow a permanent army in England 18, and hired the necessary troops from their own principality and from German friends. Naturally, these troops were paid by the British Treasury, which benefited the Jewish central bankers. Most mercenaries came from Prince William IX of Hesse-Bernau, who also was a friend of the Hanoverians. Naturally, these troops were paid by the British Treasury, which benefited the Jewish central bankers. Most mercenaries came from Prince William IX of Hesse-Bernau, who also was a friend of the Hanoverians. Chapter 3: Masonry equals freedom. In 1567, the English Freemasons split into two lodges, the York and the London. The most important time in the history of Freemasons, though, was the beginning of the 17th century, when the character of a guild of stonemasons changed to that of a mystical and occult one. The lodges were also opened for non-masons, which led to the fact that around 1,700, almost 70% of all masons, came from other professions. On June 24, 1717, representatives of the four British lodges met in London and founded the English Grand Lodge, also called the Mother Grand Lodge of the World. The new initiation system had three degrees: Entered Apprentice, Fellow Craft and Master Mason, the so-called Blue Degrees. The Grand Lodge definitely wanted for the Hanoverians to remain on the British throne and thus gave the first two degrees to Frederick, Prince of Wales, in 1737. Some of the later generations of Hanoverians even became Grand Masters: Augustus Frederick, King George IV, King Edward VII, and King George VI, yet they also had enemies. In 1688, after the overthrow of King James II, the Stuarts' supporters started several groups, among them the militant Jacobites, attempting to bring the Stuarts back to the throne. A new branch of Freemasonry, the Scottish Templar Lodge, was founded by Andrew Michael Ramsay in 1725 to support James III, and it took in former Knights Templar. This lodge had higher degrees than the Mother Grand Lodge in London, and by this it was attempted to draw members from there. 1736 saw the founding of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, which also limited the guild aspect to a minimum and fostered mysticism. In the Scottish Lodges, Templar Freemasonry was widely adhered to and later Templar degrees were given. As we see, there were now two systems of Freemasonry that were inimical: the Hanoverians in the Mother Grand Lodge in London and the Stuarts in the Scottish Templar Lodge. Who could be the third party with an interest in this conflict? Not the Illuminati, mayhap. Chapter 4: The Rothschild Family. Give me the control over a nation's currency and I don't care who makes its laws. Meyer Amschel Rothschild, 1743-1812. The secret center of international banking, the House of Rothschild, is shrouded in mystery. Meyer Amschel Bauer, a Khazar or non-Hebrew Jew, will be explained in the next chapter, was born in Frankfurt, Germany in 1743. He was the son of Moses Amschel Bauer, an itinerant moneylender and goldsmith from Eastern Europe. After working briefly for the Oppenheimer Bank in Hanover, Meyer opened a shop or counting house of his own on Judenstrasse, Jew Street, in Frankfurt. Over the doors he placed a red shield, the 19 emblem of the revolutionary-minded Khazar Jews of Eastern Europe. Shortly after, Meyer Amschel Bauer changed his name to Rothschild, in German, Rothschild equals Red Shield. His business became known as the House of Rothschild. Meyer married 16-year-old Gtel Schnpa and fathered five sons and five daughters. The sons' names were Amschel, Salomon, Nathan, Kalman, Charles, and Jacob, James. His rise to fame accelerated when he was favored by Prince William X of Hesse-Eastern Europe. Shortly after Meyer Amskelbau changed his name to Rothschild, in German, Rothschild equals Red Shield. His business became known as the House of Rothschild. Meyer married 16-year-old Gretel Schnepper and fathered 5 sons and 5 daughters. The sons' names were Amskel, Salomon, Nathan, Kalman, Charles, and Jacob, James. His rise to fame accelerated when he was favored by Prince William X of Hesse-Hanau, in whose company he attended Freemasons' meetings in Germany. Prince William, a friend of the Hanoverians, took in large sums for the Hesse mercenary armies he had loaned to the English Hanoverian king. These were the same troops who later fought the army of George Washington at Valley Forge. Rothschild became William's personal banker. When William had to flee to Denmark because of political unrest, he left the mercenaries' pay, £600,000, in Rothschild's bank for safekeeping. Nathan Rothschild, Meyer Amskel's eldest son, took this sum with him to London in order to establish another bank there. The gold that was used as security came from the East India Company. Nathan made fourfold profit from lending notes to the Duke of Wellington, who thus financed his military operations. The profits were further raised by the later illegal sale of the gold meant to serve as security. This was the origin of the gigantic wealth of the Rothschild family. Then they started international banking operations by having each son opening a bank in different countries: Amskel in Berlin, Salomon in Vienna, Jacob in Paris, and Kalman in Naples. Meyer Amskel Rothschild left a will showing how the family fortune should be handled in the future. The men would manage the assets and the eldest would have the deciding vote in differences and in important decisions. All accounts were to be kept absolutely secret, especially from the government. It is alleged that in 1773 Meyer Amskel Rothschild held a secret meeting in the house in the Judenstrasse, Jew Street, in Frankfurt with 12 influential and rich Jewish financial backers, the Elders of Zion, to forge a plan how to control the complete fortune of the world. According to Herbert G. Darcy, they spoke about the fact that the Bank of England already made a substantial control of English wealth possible, but that complete control was necessary as the foundation for the control of the fortune of the world. This was then sketched and noted down. The evidence held by Darcy and William Guy Carr, Pawns in the Game, shows this to be the plan that later became known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The origin of the protocols actually lies centuries back, but apparently they were reworked by Rothschild and thus given their importance. These protocols were kept secret until 1901, when they fell into the hands of the Russian professor S. Nihilus. He published them under the title The Jewish Peril. In 1921 Victor Marsden translated them into English under the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. These 24 protocols show today's actual situation of the world. Chapter 5 The Meetings of the Learned Elders of Zion. H. Editors, feel free to place emphasis as you target focus, that is, press, etc. There is little communication between this old computer and the other. We have no way to be able to duplicate from one to the other without great time-consuming codes. In addition, please, if there are words missing or obvious misspellings as in example to verses 2, please amend or insert sufficient words for meaning. Thank you. 20. Here is the Britain's translation of the complete text of Nihilus' Notorious Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion. The Britain's translation of the complete text of Nihilus' Notorious Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion. Protocol number 1. Putting aside fine phrases, we shall speak of the significance of each thought. By comparisons and deductions we shall throw light upon surrounding facts. What I am about to set forth, then, is our system from the two points of view, that of ourselves, and that of the Goyim, that is, human cattle equals non-Jews. It must be noted that men with bad instincts are more in number than the Gook, and therefore the best results in governing them are attained by violence and terrorization, and not by academic discussion. Every man aims at power, Everyone would like to become a dictator if only he could, and rare indeed are the men who would not be willing to sacrifice their welfare of all for the sake of securing their own welfare. What has restrained the beasts of prey who are called men? What has served for their guidance hitherto? In the beginnings of the structure of society, they were subjected to brutal and blind force, afterwards to law, which is the same force, only disguised. I draw the conclusion that by the law of nature, right lies in force. Political freedom is an idea but not a fact. This idea one must know how to apply whenever it appears necessary with this bait of an idea to attract the masses of the people to one's party for the purpose of crushing another who is in authority. This task is rendered easier if the opponent has himself been infected with the idea of freedom, so-called liberalism, and, for the sake of an idea, is willing to yield some of his power. It is precisely here that the triumph of our theory appears. The slackened reins of government are immediately, by the law of life, caught up and gathered together by a new hand, because the blind might of the nation cannot for one single day exist without guidance, and the new authority merely fits into the place of the old already weakened by liberalism. In our day, the power, which has replaced that of the rulers who were liberal, is the power of gold. Time was when faith ruled. The idea of freedom is impossible of realization because no one knows how to use it with moderation. It is enough to hand over a people to self-government for a certain length of time for that people to be turned into a disorganized mob. From that moment on we get internecine strife, which soon develops into battles between classes, in the midst of which states burn down and their importance is reduced to that of a heap of ashes. Whether a state exhausts itself in its own convulsions, whether its internal discord brings it under the power of external foes, in any case, it can be accounted irretrievably lost. It is in our power. The despotism of capital, which is entirely in our hands, reaches out to it a straw that the state, willy-nilly, must take hold of. If not, it goes to the bottom. Should anyone of a liberal mind say that such reflections as the above are immoral, I would put the following questions: if every state has two foes and if in regard to the external foe it is allowed and not considered immoral to use every manner and art of conflict, as for example to keep the enemy in ignorance of plans of attack and defense, to attack him by night or in superior numbers, then in what way can the same means in regard to a worse foe, the destroyer of the structure of society and the commonweal, be called immoral and not permissible? Is it possible for any sound logical mind to hope with any success to guide crowds by the aid of reasonable counsels and arguments, when any objection or contradiction, senseless? 21. Though it may be, can be made and when such objection may find more favor with the people, whose powers of reasoning are superficial. Men in masses and the men of the masses, being guided solely by petty passions, paltry beliefs, customs, traditions and sentimental theorism, fall a prey to party dissension, which hinders any kind of agreement even on the basis of a perfectly reasonable argument. Every resolution of a crowd depends upon a chance or pact majority, which, in its ignorance of political secrets, puts forth some ridiculous resolution that lays in the administration a seed of anarchy. The political has nothing in common with the moral. The ruler who is governed by the moral is not a skilled politician, and is therefore unstable on his throne. He who wishes to rule must have recourse both to cunning and to make-believe. Great national qualities, like frankness and honesty, are vices in politics, for they bring down rulers from their thrones more effectively and more certainly than the most powerful enemy. Such qualities must be the attributes of the kingdoms of the Goyim, and we must, in no wise, be guided by them. Our right lies in force. The word right is an abstract thought and proved by nothing. The word means no more than, give me what I want in order that thereby I might have proof that I am stronger than you. Where does right begin? Where does it end? In any state in which there is a bad organization of authority, an impersonality of laws and of the rulers who have lost their personality amid the flood of rights ever multiplying out of liberalism, I find a new right, to attack by the right of the strong, and to scatter to the winds all existing forces of order and regulation, to reconstruct all institutions and to become the sovereign lord of those who have left to us the rights of their power by laying them down voluntarily in their liberalism. Our power in the present stuttering condition of all forms of power will be more invincible than any other, because it will remain invisible until the moment when it has gained such strength that no cunning can any longer undermine it. Check it out for yourself and note that it is only now that enough uncovering is taking place to even touch the invincibles, even though a few have known truth and tried to offer it unto you the people while you slept on, and on and on. Out of the temporary evil we are now compelled to commit will emerge the good of an unshakable rule, which will restore the regular course of the machinery of the national life, brought to naught by liberalism. The result justifies the means. Let us, however, in our plans, direct our attention not so much to what is good and moral as to what is necessary and useful. Before us is a plan in which is laid down strategically the line from which we cannot deviate without running the risk of seeing the labor of many centuries brought to naught. In order to elaborate satisfactory forms of action, it is necessary to have regard to the rascality, the slackness, the instability of the mob, its lack of capacity to understand and respect the conditions of its own life, or its own welfare. It must be understood that the might of a mob is blind, senseless and unreasoning force ever at the mercy of a suggestion from any side. The blind cannot lead the blind without bringing them into the abyss. Consequently, members of the mob, upstarts from the people, even though they should be as a genius for wisdom, yet having no understanding of the political, cannot come forward as leaders of the mob without bringing the whole nation to ruin. Only one trained from childhood for independent rule can have understanding of the words that can be made up of the political alphabet. A people left to itself, that is, to upstarts from its midst, brings itself to ruin by party dissensions excited by the pursuit of power and honors and disorders arising therefrom. Is it possible for the masses of the people calmly and without petty jealousies to form judgments, to deal with the affairs of the country, which cannot be mixed up with personal interests? Can they defend themselves from an external foe? It is unthinkable, for a plan broken up into as people, whose powers of reasoning are superficial. Men in masses and the men of the masses, being guided solely by petty passions, paltry beliefs, customs, traditions and sentimental theorism, fall a prey to party dissension, which hinders any kind of agreement even on the basis of a perfectly reasonable argument. Every resolution of a crowd depends upon a chance or packed majority, which, in its ignorance of political secrets, puts forth some ridiculous resolution that lays in the administration a seed of anarchy. The political has nothing in common with the moral. The ruler who is governed by the moral is not a skilled politician, and is therefore unstable on his throne. He who wishes to rule must have recourse both to cunning and to make-believe. Great national qualities, like frankness and honesty, are vices in politics, for they bring down rulers from their thrones more effectively and more certainly than the most powerful enemy. Such qualities must be the attributes of the kingdoms of the Goyim, and we must, in no wise, be guided by them. Our right lies in force. The word right is an abstract thought and proved by nothing. The word means no more than, give me what I want in order that thereby I might have proof that I am stronger than you. Where does right begin? Where does it end? In any state in which there is a bad organization of authority, an impersonality of laws and of the rulers who have lost their personality amid the flood of rights ever multiplying out of liberalism, I find a new right, to attack by the right of the strong, and to scatter to the winds all existing forces of order and regulation, to reconstruct all institutions and to become the sovereign lord of those who have left to us the rights of their power by laying them down voluntarily in their liberalism. Our power in the present stuttering condition of all forms of power will be more invincible than any other, because it will remain invisible until the moment when it has gained such strength that no cunning can any longer undermine it. Check it out for yourself and note that it is only now that enough uncovering is taking place to even touch the invincibles, even though a few have known truth and tried to offer it unto you the people while you slept on, and on and on, out of the temporary evil we are now compelled to commit will emerge the good of an unshakable rule, which will restore the regular course of the machinery of the national life, brought to naught by liberalism. The result justifies the means. Let us, however, in our plans, direct our attention not so much to what is good and moral as to what is necessary and useful. Before us is a plan in which is laid down strategically the line from which we cannot deviate without running the risk of seeing the labor of many centuries brought to naught. In order to elaborate satisfactory forms of action, it is necessary to have regard to the rascality, the slackness, the instability of the mob, its lack of capacity to understand and respect the conditions of its own life, or its own welfare. It must be understood that the might of a mob is blind, senseless and unreasoning force ever at the mercy of a suggestion from any side. The blind cannot lead the blind without bringing them into the abyss. Consequently, members of the mob, upstarts from the people, even though they should be as a genius for wisdom, yet having no understanding of the political, cannot come forward as leaders of the mob without bringing the whole nation to ruin. Only one trained from childhood for independent rule can have understanding of the words that can be made up of the political alphabet. A people left to itself, that is, to upstarts from its midst, brings itself to ruin by party dissensions excited by the pursuit of power and honors and disorders arising therefrom. Is it possible for the masses of the people calmly and without petty jealousies to form judgments, to deal with the affairs of the country, which cannot be mixed up with personal interests? Can they defend themselves from an external foe? It is unthinkable, for a plan broken up into as 22. Many parts as there are heads in the mob, loses all homogeneity, and thereby becomes unintelligible and impossible of execution. It is only with a despotic ruler that plans can be elaborated extensively and clearly in such a way as to distribute the whole properly among the several parts of the machinery of the state. From this the conclusion is inevitable that a satisfactory form of government for any country is one that concentrates in the hand of one responsible person. Without an absolute despotism, there can be no existence for civilization which is carried on, not by the masses but by their guide, whosoever that person may be. The mob is a savage and displays its savagery at every opportunity. The moment the mob seizes freedom in its hands, it quickly turns to anarchy, which in itself is the highest degree of savagery. Behold the alcoholized animals, bemused with drink, the right to an immoderate use of which comes along with freedom. H. Take a good hard look at yourself, please. It is not for us and ours to walk that road. The peoples of the Goyim are bemused with alcoholic liquors. Their youth has grown stupid on classicism, and independent rule can have from early immorality, into which it has been inducted by our special agents, by tutors, lackeys, governesses in the houses of the wealthy, by clerks and others, by our women in the places of dissipation frequented by the Goyim. In the number of these last I count also the so-called society ladies, voluntary followers of the others in corruption and luxury. Our countersign is force and make-believe. Only force conquers in political affairs, especially if it be concealed in the talents essential to statesmen. Violence must be the principle, and cunning and makes-believe the rule for governments which do not want to lay down their crowns at the feet of agents of some new power. This evil is the one and only means to attain the end, the good. Therefore we must not stop at bribery, deceit and treachery when they should serve towards the attainment of our end. In politics one must know how to seize the property of others without hesitation if by it we secure submission and sovereignty. Our state, marching along the path of peaceful conquest, has the right to replace the horrors of war by less noticeable and more satisfactory sentences of death, necessary to maintain the terror which tends to produce blind submission. Just by merciless severity is the greatest factor of strength in the state, not only for the sake of gain but also in the name of duty, for the sake of victory. We must keep to the program of violence and make believe. The doctrine of squaring accounts is precisely as strong as the means of which it makes use. Therefore it is not so much by the means themselves as by the doctrine of severity that we shall triumph and bring all governments into subjection to our supergovernment. It is enough for them to know that we are merciless for all disobedience to cease.